That just might be the world's most recognizable newborn cry. That sweet baby babble is from Stevie Wonder's 1976 Isn't She Lovely? And it is still a bop 55 years after Wonder celebrated the birth of his daughter with these words. This is the romantic sugar plum vision of what to expect when you're expecting. A strong, healthy baby born into the loving arms of well-prepared parents who've joyfully anticipated her arrival. It is a lovely vision and worthy aspiration for the start of life. But it's just one of the many ways new humans enter the world. The many different realities of birth are where we begin on today's episode of The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I'm joined by Dorian Warren, co-president of Community Change, co-founder of the Economic Security Project, and my co-host for Takeaway Deep Dives. Hey, Dorian.
Hey, Melissa. Isn't she lovely indeed? And it's always so good to be with you on The Takeaway. This week, we are exploring the one experience which is absolutely necessary and entirely irreplaceable to continue humanity, childbirth.
Look, it's a good point. I mean, reproductive technologies have innovated strategies in kind of some surprising new ways to fertilize eggs, to grow early embryos, but there's still only one way that potential human life becomes an actualized human. A pregnant person must give birth.
That's an interesting phrase, Melissa. A pregnant person must give birth. Because last week, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the Mississippi abortion restriction case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health. And if the Supreme Court overturns Roe versus Wade, then many people who otherwise might have chosen to terminate their pregnancies will be compelled to carry those pregnancies to term. Meaning that a pregnant person must give birth could become a legal requirement and lived reality.
We're not going to know about the Mississippi ruling for at least a month. But on Friday, the court released its decision to let stand a restrictive abortion law out of Texas, which effectively bans most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Now, this decision, it's complex, and it's going to be the subject of significant analysis in coming days. But just to be clear, the key outcomes are that the court's allowing the Texas law to remain in effect for the time being. The court did fully reject one of the challenges to that law, which was brought by the federal government, but the court did allow a second challenge, one that was brought by abortion providers themselves, to proceed. So for now, Roe v. Wade remains precedent. But people who are pregnant today in the state of Texas are subject to the country's most restrictive terms if they want to terminate their pregnancies. And at 6 weeks, many won't even know they're pregnant. So Dorian, we got to be judicious, right? As we're awaiting the decision in the Mississippi case. But it's worth noting, if the court overturns Roe, it will mean that many more pregnant people will be required by the laws of the state to give birth. And whether you celebrate this outcome as a hard-won pro-life victory or decry it as a devastating blow in the battle for reproductive justice, I think it's critical for us as a nation to openly and honestly understand what is at stake when we require pregnant people to give birth.
And that is why this is the right time for a deep dive on childbirth. And even though childbirth has become a social and political issue, it is such an intimate experience that we wanted to begin with your personal stories out there. Here is some of what you told us about how you have experienced childbirth.
My name's Lisa Burns. I'm from Dallas, Texas. When I was pregnant, I was diagnosed with stage 4 triple negative breast cancer that was quickly metastasizing through my body. as a consequence, I had to do chemotherapy while I was pregnant with my daughter. She had had enough of it after two tries. And so after the second chemotherapy, she was delivered the next day at 37 weeks. She was healthy, but it was definitely a harrowing experience going through that at the same time.
Hello, my name is Christina. I'm calling from Houghton, Michigan. Both my birth experiences were very risky, but especially my second one. My son was born prematurely, and then he was taken away from me at birth to go to a NICU approximately 2 hours away. 2 days later, I almost died and never got to hold him from complications related to HELLP syndrome. My liver and kidneys basically shut down. I was bleeding out. It took at least six blood transfusions and four plasma transfusions, and then days being on magnesium sulfide to prevent seizures to save my life, and a second surgery. And I knew that if I didn't come out of the second surgery, I would die, never having to get to hold my son.
Hi, this is Lucia from Northern Wisconsin, and I have four awesome sons, all delivered naturally. The best delivery I had was with my third son. I had a midwife, and she had me deliver on my side because of really bad back labor, because I have a tipped uterus. It was the least painful of all four, and actually, he delivered very smoothly, and everybody was there, brothers and grandma included. The worst was my last delivery. 2.5 months early, they tried to stop the contractions with mag sulfate, which really was torture in itself. And finally, after seeing that it was not helping the contractions, I was allowed to give birth. So 11 hours start to finish, and I went from 6 centimeters to birth in 10 minutes. Ouch. I'm glad he was the last, because if he was the first, he probably would have been the only.
Now, thanks to everybody who called in to share those stories. I mean, clearly, Dorian, there's no single story that captures all birth experiences. But let's just pause for a second and try to understand a few things that tend to characterize childbirth in the U.S. today. So according to CDC statistics, birth rates have been declining in the U.S. for more than a decade. They've fallen each year in every racial category and every age group. And women are also delaying motherhood. Back in 1980, the median age when a woman had her first child was about 23 years old. Today, the median age is nearly 28. And more than 98% of births, they occur in hospitals. But there are some families who choose birthing centers or even their own home as the best place to welcome new life. In this country, about 1 in 3 babies are born via cesarean. That is the highest rate for surgical birth in the world. Also, a full 71% of labors are assisted by epidurals.
Melissa, as the dad of a 14-month-old, I must admit that, frankly, finding credible, useful information about childbirth was sometimes difficult. And obviously, the internet is full of information. But navigating that search engine result for childbirth can feel like trying to walk through a potential minefield. For us, we had a great doctor who helped us understand what to expect and to figure out what we wanted. But with more than 4 million births in this country every year, it can be difficult to define an optimal birthing experience.
The number one thing that people tell me is they want to be able to birth or have the experience be the way that they would like the experience to be.
This is Dr. Monica McLemore, Associate Professor of Family Healthcare Nursing at the University of California, San Francisco.
A lot of times people want their family members around. They want to be able to have their traditional music and foods. They want the experience of their imagination to match the experience that they actually have. They are surprised that it is a battle when they want simple things like to get in a birthing tub or, you know, whether or not they want an IV or not, or if they want to sit on the birthing ball or whatever. They are really surprised by the disconnect between the way they imagine their birth experience to be and what it truly is. And so part of my work that I'm doing now is to really try and make those things more congruent so that people can have the empowering birth experience they really, really want, and to take some of the battle out of it.
Now, that goal of being empowered to manage the direction and experience of giving birth is an ideal many of us have at the start of pregnancy, even at the start of labor. But boy, it can dissolve rapidly.
The sad reality is that out of every 100,000 women who give birth in this country, 17 will die as a result of complications from childbirth. Now, just to put that in context, this number means that the United States ranks last among industrialized nations. It means the American maternal mortality rate is double that of Canada and France, more than 5 times higher than Germany and the Netherlands, and more than 15 times higher than New Zealand.
It's important for us to note that you know, globally, we use this metric as a barometer for the health and wellness of a nation, because technically, you know, childbearing families and pregnant capable people should be some of the healthiest and youngest individuals, you know, and have good health outcomes.
And Dr. McLemore pushed us to expand our understanding of the risks and challenges of childbirth. Maternal death is not the only possible bad outcome.
So frustrating when people talk about pregnancy as if it's a risk-free experience. And people don't take it seriously that the only true arbiters of how pregnancy goes can be the pregnant people who have to take on said risk. That's why it's so important that we have these discussions and conversations, because, you know, pregnancy in and of itself is not without risk, regardless of its outcome. There are lifelong impacts that will happen if there is a traumatic birth or a birth that has some, you know, kind of situation that requires intervention. That really sort of, I think, can be very, very disruptive across the life course. So, you know, just because you don't die doesn't necessarily mean that you are set up, you know, to be the most effective or to be the most capable or to even be the most physiologically present parent, you know, and for your family.
And she explained that maternal mortality in the U.S. is not an equally shared risk. Black women are much more likely than white or Hispanic women to die from complications associated with childbirth.
So when we think about the fact that, you know, Black women, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes, you know, it makes you wonder about, you know, what is it, you know, about our health system and our healthcare providers that really, really is contributing to, you know, numbers as stark as that.
Okay, Melissa, I see how we are plunging deeper. First, we have these big global disparities showing that the U.S. is way behind all the other high-income nations when it comes to maternal death. One level deeper, we see it's not just about death, but also about these other traumatic experiences. And then, even deeper, we can see clearly these racial disparities within our own country.
You get a more balanced and nuanced picture of the experience of childbirth. And let me be very clear, I've never been pregnant. And so for me, one of the reasons why I'm such a deep listener to other people's pregnancy and birth and pregnancy and abortion and pregnancy and whatever outcome experiences, because it's not one I've ever had. And as a clinician who's taken care of a lot of people who do, and as a researcher who studies these things, I think it's super important for me to have the wisdom and the humility to develop deep listening skills so I can create and curate space for us to have a more nuanced conversation about this.
Deep listening. This framework is so much at odds with the way pop culture tends to present the experience of childbirth. I mean, Dorian, just think about sitcoms and rom-coms. There is always so much drama and huffing and puffing and breathless car races to the hospital and cheap laughs.
Ricky, this is it.
This is it.
I'm Phoebe Buffay, and I have babies coming out of me.
You're pregnant?
Yes.
Ow!
Well, don't panic, miss. It may just be false labor.
Wait a minute, Robert. Which way are you going? This is the LIE. I said to take the bridge.
I want you to imagine that your uterus is like a tube of toothpaste, and you're just trying to squeeze out all that minty fresh gel.
Yeah, and you know, having just been with my partner as she gave birth to our first child, during a pandemic, by the way, and this was before vaccines were available, Melissa, I can attest to the fact that Hollywood movies are definitely not the place to get your labor and delivery information.
I think if we got our healthcare systems and institutions to understand that, you know, we need both approaches. We need both a cheerleader, but we also need interventionists. But we need interventionists only when intervention is necessary, right? So it's this give information to inform, right, so that people can be prepared. But it's also cheerleading to be able to say, and you know what, your body was built to do this, and we're going to help you. You know, a lot of people think that technology and access to interventions is equitable to, you know, good outcomes. Birth, again, is a normal physiological process. And over-intervention, I believe, is one of the reasons why we have such poor outcomes.
The Queen of the Courts is revealing the dramatic story behind the birth of her daughter and life as a new mom. Williams saying she had to deliver baby Olympia by emergency C-section in September, saying the moment her new daughter was laid on her chest was an amazing feeling, and then everything went bad.
Now, we were just listening to a 2018 Good Morning America segment about the harrowing childbirth experience that nearly took the life of tennis superstar Serena Williams. The day after delivering her daughter, Williams was having trouble breathing, and she alerted medical staff of her long history of blood clots. But she had trouble convincing them to take her concerns seriously. And when, after hours of self-advocacy, she was finally given the proper diagnostic test, doctors found several potentially life-threatening blood clots in her lungs. And they began then treatment right away.
This story is just incredible, Melissa. Serena Williams has a net worth of more than $200 million. She has more Grand Slam wins than any other tennis player in history. But her wealth, her fame, her deep knowledge of her own body as an elite athlete, all of that did not give her enough credibility with the hospital staff to have her concerns immediately heard and addressed.
And you know, I remember this, it was so interesting to me because when Williams shared her story with Vogue back in 2018, it was the first time that many Americans had even really learned about the deadly maternal mortality rates in the U.S.
I'm Dr. Joya Creer Perry, founder and president of the National Birth Equity Collaborative.
Dr. Creer Perry is a national leader on issues of maternal mortality.
Technically, through the World Health Organization and international spaces, we count the number of women who die or the number of people who have a baby and die within 42 days, within 6 weeks of having a baby. And so that's an international standard. And there's a list and rankings because it's also an indicator of how well a society is doing. The United States has the worst maternal health outcomes of any industrialized nation, and our numbers have been getting worse in the last 20 years.
She sees a clear connection between maternal mortality and an inadequate system of public support for pregnancy and childbirth.
The mismatch between how much we spend on healthcare delivery and how poor our healthcare outcomes are shows us that our premise is off. Our belief on how to fix the problem is off. The countries that have better outcomes, the high-income nations around the world, they believe in a human right to health, that health is a human right. And so they do things like universal healthcare. They do things like paid leave, paid paternity leave. They do all these things to make sure that moms are safe and babies are safe and have a social safety net and healthcare service. And they do it through governmental programs. They believe that it's the duty of the nation to invest in supporting the people of it, their citizens in their country. We don't do that.
Dr. Creer Perry's organization, the National Birth Equity Collaborative, authored an amicus brief in the current abortion case being considered by the Supreme Court. So she talked to us about the connection between maternal mortality and abortion access.
It's not like we didn't know it was coming, unfortunately. We've had a preview of this for the last at least 10 years. Many lowercase courts, we knew that the states where I live, like Louisiana, or where I've trained and practiced medicine, were practicing bills already that could lead up to going to the Supreme Court. And so we know that we don't invest in things like Medicaid expansion. We have many thousands of people in Mississippi who don't have access to health care, who don't have any paid leave, who don't have child care. So it is doubly harmful to me to say, in spite of us not investing in the human beings who live, who are citizens of this state, to be able to thrive, we're also going to say, we don't value you when you're carrying a child. We're going to see more moms die, more babies die, and it's not safer. In fact, it causes more harm and more injury.
Earlier this week, Dr. Creer Perry was a participant in the White House Maternal Day of Action Summit. Vice President Harris opened the event.
The truth is women in our nation, and this is a hard truth, women in our nation are dying. Before, during, and after childbirth, Women in our nation are dying at a higher rate than any other developed nation in our world. And when we know that for some women, the risk is much higher, when we know that, we should do something about it. When we know that today, Black women are 3 times as likely to die from pregnancy-related complications, we should do something about that.
Black women are 3 times more likely to die. It's easy to assume it's due to gaps in education or income or health insurance, but Melissa, none of those factors fully explain it. In fact, a Black mother with a college education is at 60% greater risk for maternal death than a white or Hispanic woman with less than a high school education.
It's true. It's an odd statistic that way. It's not, race really is standing for race here, not for socioeconomic status. But that doesn't mean we should ignore how policy can make a difference. I mean, Dr. Claire Perry told us about how an expansion of Medicaid, paid parental leave, affordable housing and childcare policies could all greatly improve childbirth outcomes. But while these policies could raise the floor on maternal mortality, meaning fewer women overall would die, it's not clear that they would change the gap between Black and white women. Because when it comes to childbirth, race matters.
When I was in medical school in the late 1990s in Louisiana, I was taught that there are 3 biological races, Mongoloid, Caucasoid, and Negroid. I'm not talking about the 50s and 60s. I'm talking about 1990s. So here I am in a class that in every other medical school in the United States is named embryology. But in my class, it's called human prenatal development. And my professor not only was racist and still teaching the biological basis of race as a essentialism argument in the 90s to medical students at a state-funded medical school, he was also showing us videos of fetuses. And he was a part of this thing called the Fetus Project, and they were showing that fetuses could feel pain.
Whether a fetus feels pain is a matter of significant scientific dispute. But we know that people giving birth feel pain. And research shows Black women and Latinas are less likely to be given epidurals to manage pain during labor. And that even though Black women and Latinas tend to report more pain after giving birth, they are given less medical assistance to address their pain.
Now I want to dive down one more level, Dorian, and put this denial of pain management in historical context. You see, the entire field of modern obstetrics is credited to the work of J. Marion Sims, who's typically called the father of modern gynecology. And Sims innovated many of the tools and techniques still used in modern reproductive medical practice. Sims, he perfected his surgical techniques by operating on enslaved Black women who had to endure repeated, painful procedures without any kind of sedation or pain relief. At least one woman, Anarka, she endured at least 30 surgeries performed by Sims. Anarka and the other women that Sims used in his research did not control their own bodies. They could not make choices about how or when or for whom to work. They weren't even able to love and rear the children that they bore. They were probably teenagers when they gave birth to the babies that shredded their bodies. Children who were not their own, but belonged to a white man who could hurt them or harm them, use them or sell them in any way that he saw fit. That means these women could not consent to the procedures Sims performed. They were given to Sims by the same man who owned them and who owned their children. And for an enslaved Black woman, giving birth meant creating another slave. So when we talk about Black maternal mortality, we cannot forget that intergenerational chattel bondage meant that Black birth always brought forth the social death of slavery.
Most good doulas I know, they are cultural witnesses to the process of birth. They are ambassadors to welcome a birthing person to their new role as a parent and to shepherd that new human into this world with love and protection. The magic and the secret sauce of doulas is that they remember that it's a human process, not just a clinical one.
You just heard the voice of Dr. Monica McLemore, Associate Professor of Nursing at the University of San Francisco, as she told us about the secret sauce of doulas. Research shows doulas improve birth outcomes. Babies born in doula-assisted births are 4 times less likely to have low birth weight, 2 times less likely to experience a birth complication, and much more likely to initiate breastfeeding.
Hi, my name is Tracy Collins. I'm the CEO and the founder of the National Black Doulas Association.
Tracy talked about how doulas make a difference in childbirth.
A doula is a labor support person who helps support from an emotional, physical, or informational standpoint for birthing families. The way that you help really support people and help prepare them for all possibilities is that you want to make sure that your clients are as fluid as water so they can give birth to their child. I'm not a fan of the word birth plan versus your birth preferences or your birth wishes. And we are going to do our best to stick to these based upon how your labor is progressing. And always knowing that we are going to make the best decision based on the health and wellness and safety of all involved parties. And also arming the birthing family with the necessary power and understanding that they are actually the boss, not the insurance company, not the doctor.
Faced with historic and contemporary racial bias in medicine, it can be harder for Black people to be the boss of their labor and delivery process.
When a Black girl hires a doula, they're not doing it from a vanity standpoint. They're doing it simply because they understand the structure that they're up against, and they want to make sure that they arm themselves with the right support people to help usher them into safety. And that is the difference.
Which is why Tracy founded the National Black Doula Association.
It was because I knew I had to do something about the Black maternal mortality and morbidity rate in this country. And I did not know what that looked like. All I knew is I needed to do something. I was pulled to do something. And we know representation matters.
Yet even as Tracy and other Black doulas create safer childbirth experiences for their clients, they find themselves professionally and personally vulnerable.
I came into the field as a doula, and then I transitioned into midwifery about 2 or 3 years into my career. However, being the only Black girl at the time, and oftentimes I'm in that space of being the only Black girl in a predominantly white area of space, it just did not resonate well with me, because birthing professionals know that all birth doesn't end in life. Anything can happen throughout the course of labor and delivery. And birthing professionals know that, and no one ever wants to ever have a client or be that person that transitions during that process. And we have to be prepared for all possibilities when it comes to working in this profession. And it's imperative that you understand the things that can arise from a physiological standpoint that can be the determining factor of life and death.
That's why her organization not only supports families and babies, it also supports doulas.
I did not understand the actual gap between white birthing professionals and Black birthing professionals when it came to compensation. And it's okay for those organizations to put our bodies, who are training as birthing professionals, to use, you know, be used as community doulas. But when it comes to actually giving them credit, acknowledging them, and helping them level up in the field, no one supports them. So I didn't understand that, because here I was, you know, once we said like the only Black girl, I was like, wait a minute, this is not true. There needs to be something done about this. You can help families, but also be in a position to where your cup does not have to be empty.
I was there when my 7-year-old daughter was born, but I was not the one delivering her. The experience forced me to confront my understanding of risk, my commitment to bodily autonomy and choice, and my experience of love.
Hi, my name is Heather.
On February 14th, 2014, Heather gave birth to my second daughter, Anna. Now, 6 years earlier, my long battle with fibroids had ended with a hysterectomy. But with the help of IVF, my husband and I could still make an embryo. but without a uterus, I was unable to carry a pregnancy. Heather, a married mother of two, agreed to do it for me.
So I had my own personal setbacks on my journey to parenthood. So I had an ectopic pregnancy, which required emergency surgery. Then I got pregnant with twins. And then at 12 weeks, I found out I lost one of them. So just in my worry of, you know, am I ever going to be able to have kids? I just had this moment where I just had this thought and, you know, made a promise to God, you know, if you just let this work out for me, and this baby's healthy, I'll do whatever I can to help somebody else out.
Heather has definitely made good on that promise. She has two fantastic children of her own and has been a surrogate for three families. Anna was her first surro baby. And initially, look, our journey was actually pretty easy. Heather became pregnant on the first transfer. Every doctor's appointment showed healthy, normal growth. And Heather looked beautiful and felt strong. But then it got complicated. The doctor diagnosed partial placenta previa. It's a condition that can cause severe bleeding during both the pregnancy and delivery. Now, Heather and I, we text and talk regularly. But this conversation is the first time in 7 years that she and I have talked about the experience of childbirth that we shared.
It just very much felt like my own. However, there's a lot more pressure added to it. There's a lot of, and for us, because, you know, I had some complications with the partial previa, I had a lot of moments where it was a struggle for me and that I felt like, you know, my body maybe was sort of failing me, where I don't think that I would have necessarily been as hard on myself if it was my own baby.
Here we were having to make a decision about how this childbirth was going to happen and when. And this was your body, full stop, your body. And yet, weirdly, that was my baby. And I thought, whoa, Melissa, you gotta slow down. You like there is no your baby that is not also Heather's body.
Yes, that definitely was the moment when, okay, surrogacy gets real. Where you know, there's just this balance there of, you know, obviously for me, yep, it's my body. And we, you know, unfortunately, we had differing medical opinions on what was going to be safe. And I just really, you know, my reaction would have been, okay, let's do this. Let's roll the dice and have this baby the way that I want to vaginally. But then knowing that, yes, it's still my decision. This is not my baby. And I will never forgive myself if something were to happen. Obviously, you know, your surrogate goes through so much. The intended parent goes through so much that the last thing you want to do is make a wrong call, which is, you know, ultimately why we just left it to my OB. But yeah, that's where it just really got difficult, that I just had to think outside of myself and what I wanted to physically do, what would be easier for me to do.
And it was, that was tough. I mean, on the one hand, I kind of felt good, like, oh, thank goodness, we're going to make this choice, until I was standing there in the delivery room with you and I was seeing the C-section and I was like, oh my God, like this is not some small thing. Like we're standing in this room and there is a major operation that Heather did not want to happen. And it is happening. Yeah.
That was a hard one for me because, you know, I didn't want a C-section, but for this one, I'm well rested. I'm wide awake and terrified, and you know, they start this procedure and I don't feel good, and I remember telling my doctor, I really don't know how I'm going to get through this, and them telling me, you just need to close your eyes and find a happy place and find it quickly. And so that was such a disappointment.
I think about all that, right? All the complicated emotions you were feeling and I was feeling, the choices that your doctor was making, but all of these were still choices that we got to make. These were still decisions, bad, good, right, wrong, that we were able to make.
To me, these are choices that need to be made personally and with a doctor, and nobody else's opinion really should matter.
Is there anything I'm missing? Anything else you want to be sure we get in?
I don't think so. Other than, you know, I'm just the best surrogate around.
I so appreciate everybody taking a moment to listen to the story that Heather and I share. But as we talked about at the beginning, there's no one story of childbirth. So we are so grateful to all of you who shared your stories. Let's take a listen.
Hi, my name is Amy. I'm from Ferndale, Washington. I gave birth for the first time in a hospital in Seattle, Washington, in 1994. And it was very traumatizing. I want to make it clear that nothing that happened to me was outside the bounds of normal practice for that time, but normal practice was traumatizing. The main thing that happened was I had a prolonged labor, not dangerous, but prolonged. And because of that, they brought in an obstetrician to back up my family doctor who was doing the delivery. And when the birth finally was happening, my doctor was seated in the catching position and the obstetrician was standing behind her. And without saying a word to anybody, not to me or to my doctor, the obstetrician leaned over my doctor's shoulder with a pair of scissors and cut me an episiotomy, which was something I had very specifically been trying to avoid having and had had that conversation with my doctor. So after that, I said, I'm not going back to a hospital unless it's in an ambulance. And I had my next two children at home with a midwife, Seattle midwifery, yay! And had very normal, ordinary births that were wonderful and empowering and actually went a really long way towards healing the feeling of helplessness and non-agency that the hospital birth had left me with.
A lot of the ways the hospital system is built around rooms that you've never been to, people you've never met, those are conditions that are very much not conducive to women having positive natural childbirth experiences, and that women really need to be in environments that they're familiar with and very comfortable in and with people they know to give birth naturally, and that our hospital settings and our system of having birth really contradicts that 100%. And I just find it interesting how many of my friends have gone into childbirth trying to maximize a positive experience, whereas my perspective was to minimize what I thought would be a painful and difficult experience.
My name is Marilyn Mitchell, and I'm calling from Pawling, New York. I'm a retired nurse. As a nurse, started working as a student in labor and delivery and witnessed really highly medicalized births in the 1970s, where women were literally knocked out, doctors used forceps, and nurses took both of their forearms and pressed on the top of women's abdomens in an effort to help get the baby out. It was pretty crazy. And then that transitioned very quickly to women wanting no medication, using Lamaze breathing, and it was a time in which we'd also have many women screaming their lungs out, which is very different than what it had been in the 70s. And then before you knew it, by the 90s, women were saying, I want my epidural now, as they walked into the labor and delivery unit before they were even in labor.
As always, thanks for being part of the Takeaway conversation.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and together we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
If she had ingested cocaine pre-viability and had the same negative consequences to her child, do you think the state had an interest in enforcing that law against her?
Justice Clarence Thomas during the oral arguments in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health earlier this month.
What Justice Thomas did was acknowledge that criminalization of everyone who gets pregnant, whether they're seeking to end a pregnancy or to give birth, could, under his view of the law, be subject to surveillance from the moment they get pregnant.
That was Lynn Paltrow, executive director and founder of National Advocates for Pregnant Women, giving us some context for understanding why Thomas was invoking that particular case.
What he seemed to be saying in his, I would have to argue, somewhat fantasy land, is the claim that the Supreme Court has already sanctioned the use of criminal laws, such as child neglect law, to reach people who become pregnant from the moment of fertilization. He was asking questions about whether or not they lose the right to bodily autonomy, not specifically limited to abortion, but to everything, because the example he gave was of a criminal child neglect law as used to prosecute and convict somebody of a crime because they were pregnant.
Now, is it me, or does this sound like some move toward a dystopian society like The Handmaid's Tale?
Yes, the description of state surveillance and control of people with pregnancy as the excuse for doing so is not fiction. As Margaret Atwood in interviews herself has said, nothing in her book was based on pure imagination. It was based on her observations of what had already happened.
The stories Lynn recounted are chilling. I mean, they reveal the ways that low-income women of color are already defined and treated as threats to their own pregnancies. It's an idea that keeps taking me back to how slave societies understood the bodies of enslaved women, not as something that belonged to them, but as something that could be put to use to profit someone else.
If you focus on pregnancy and drug use, you get the double stigmatization. You get the stigmatization of the people who get pregnant being framed as murderers, because abortion, as they claim it, is murder. You're describing overwhelmingly mothers. More than half of the women who have abortions are already mothers. They're being described as criminals. We've worked on cases where women have already been arrested for being pregnant and falling down a flight of stairs, not following their doctor's advice, imprisoned in hospitals because they tried to leave the hospital while pregnant to go home to take care of their two children, keeping her there, allegedly to prevent her from having a miscarriage, even forcing her to undergo cesarean surgery, and still losing the pregnancy.
This is a claim that the state has an interest in childbirth, and it's a so-called compelling interest that it allows the state to deprive a citizen of their liberty, an interest that allows the state to criminalize, confine, and punish the person who will have to give birth to the child.
No one can guarantee a healthy birth outcome, a healthy pregnancy, not doctors, not the women themselves. There's so much research in the context of why the maternal mortality rate is so high, and especially high for Black women in the United States, is the growing understanding that it has very little to do with what the woman does or doesn't do during the 9 months of pregnancy, but everything to do with the lifetime of stress of what's called weathering from ongoing racism and assaults that people experience. And we pay far too little attention to the environment, the social context, the political context in which people live, and make it seem as if the people who get pregnant, if they just did a better job, they could have had a healthy pregnancy.
And here, Paltrow's getting us to think carefully about whether the state is using its power to protect pregnancy and ensure healthy birth. So let's for a second talk about a case out of Gainesville, Florida. The Gainesville chapter of the Dream Defenders has been raising the alarm about this for months.
Stand up my back! Stand up my back!
We don't get it!
Shut it down!
If we don't...
Yeah, Melissa, back in August, 25-year-old Erica Thompson was arrested for a parole violation. At the time of the arrest, Thompson was 6 months pregnant. Already a mother of two, she repeatedly insisted that she felt she was going into labor. But instead of taking her to the hospital, deputies took her to jail.
And then, a few hours later, she delivered a tiny preterm baby daughter. And Erica says no one assisted her during childbirth. A few hours after that, the baby went into cardiac arrest and died at the University of Florida Hospital. And see, here's the thing, Dorian. Just the year before, in June of 2020, the state of Florida unanimously passed the Tammy Jackson Act.
Tammy Jackson is a human being. She's a mother and she's a woman. Regardless of her background or the challenges she may have in her life, it is not no one's job to deny her proper health and safety.
The law was introduced after another Black mama, Tammy Jackson, was left in isolation in a Florida jail where she gave birth alone. And so this new law requires that a pregnant inmate, quote, be transported to an appropriate medical facility without delay, given proper medical care, and not placed in restrictive housing involuntarily. But more than a year after the law was passed, Erica Thompson gave birth alone in an Allacoocha County jail cell. And her baby did not survive.
And I gotta say, I honestly have to wonder if Justice Thomas thinks that those public officials should be held accountable in the same way that he wants to criminalize pregnant women. Here again is Lynn Paltrow.
People describe what we do as like slippery slope arguments, but we actually work at the bottom of that slippery slope. We're already there. And there have been cases. An Indigenous woman was sentenced to 4 years in prison for experiencing a miscarriage. She lost the pregnancy between 15 and 17 weeks, and the loss was blamed on methamphetamine, except methamphetamine didn't cause her pregnancy loss. It can't cause pregnancy loss. We're in touch with leading forensic pathologists, people who study the placenta. All of them agree methamphetamine does not cause pregnancy losses. And yet Adora Perez in California is serving 11 years for manslaughter for having experienced a pregnancy loss that a prosecutor linked to her drug use.
So listen, the story of childbirth doesn't end when the umbilical cord is cut. In many ways, that's just the start of the story. If the court reverses Roe versus Wade because the state has a compelling interest in pregnancy and birth, then it should have to accept that the state has a responsibility to ensure that all families can thrive. And that starts with paid family and medical leave.
My name is Josephine Calapenny. I'm the executive director of Family Values at Work.
Now, during our conversation, Josie made one thing very clear. Paid leave is critical to healthy childbirth.
There's so much anticipation when you're welcoming a new baby, no matter how that baby enters your home. And the reality is that many parents of older children need time to both bond with their child, but also just to heal themselves. It's already a lot to figure out the transition of new parenting, but then to figure out how to be off of work when missing pay may be the only way to be off of work is really an additional factor that many parents just don't need in the equation of welcoming a new child.
Paid family leave ensures a temporary basic level of economic stability. And that stability generates the most precious resource for parents of a new baby. Time.
What we know is that 6 weeks is the bare minimum that parents need to bond and to have, you know, to really spend time with their children to make sure that children are healthy. But we also know that it's just not sufficient. It's not sufficient time. We know that many people are experiencing, especially Black women, are experiencing physical, mental, and emotional trauma during childbirth and need the additional time to have leave to be able to prepare their bodies and to really be able to bond with their children. We know that 6 weeks, you know, it can sound like a lot when you're in the moment, but we know that we actually need more.
We need more. This is a mantra that advocates have repeated for decades. Way back in 1993, our country achieved an important step with the Family Medical Leave Act, or FMLA. The FMLA is no doubt important. It ensures 12 weeks of unpaid leave, which means that an employee won't lose their job for taking time off to heal or to bond with their child after childbirth. But FMLA does not apply to all employers or all employees. It covers full-time, long-term workers in public agencies, public and private schools, and companies with 50 or more employees. That's why we need more.
And of course, it only requires that employers offer unpaid leave. But babies are expensive. Parents have to continue to house, clothe, feed, and transport themselves and any other family members. Then add the cost of a car seat. Can't even go home from the hospital without that. Stroller, crib, diapers. And most families are also going to have to pay for the childbirth. Even with insurance, labor and delivery costs average more than $5,000. Who can afford these costs if they don't get a paycheck for 12 weeks? Dorian, we undoubtedly need more.
And, you know, going back to work might not make it easier to make ends meet. The Center for American Progress estimates that center-based childcare costs almost $16,000 a year. We need more. And that's why the Build Back Better Act initially included 12 weeks of paid leave for all employees. In the current version, that's been pared back to 4 weeks of paid leave.
We know that's not enough. We know 6 weeks is the minimum, but we actually know that what's needed is 12 weeks. We know 12 weeks is what's needed for parents to heal and to recover and to also bond and spend time with a child. We know that the more time that parents can spend bonding with children, the outcomes, the return on that level of investment in early childhood development and in the development of children, it gets us more in the long run.
Josie gave us historical context to understand why we don't have more.
The idea that we wouldn't take the time to compensate people when they need to take time off to be with their own children is hints of slavery. The idea that a Black woman should be able to work underpaid in this economy, regardless of health and wellness, should not be able to take the time off and should lose their job if they need to take time off is hints. And it's remnants of slave policy from, you know, way back when we know that that's the foundation of this country. And we have to dismantle that. We have to dismantle that in how we think and approach policy, how we think and approach programs and communities, and how we build this country forward.
And Josie also talked about why she believes everyone should care about paid leave, even those who will never give birth to a child.
I am a childless working adult, and I hope that I'm seen as one of the largest advocates, loudest advocates for paid family and medical leave. I think about myself as the auntie that shows up when my parent friends need someone to show up for their kid. I have parent friends who have kids that I love who themselves don't have paid family and medical leave. So when their kid is sick, I'm the one they call on to be at home with their child when they can't take off of work. So even without children, the impacts of paid family and medical leave on this whole country, especially on women, especially on working women, especially on our ability to actually build back better versus building back the status quo is critical.
Versus building back the status quo. No going back, Melissa, given all the ground in history we've covered, from the medical professionalization of childbirth to maternal and infant mortality to the work of doulas and midwifery, and of course, the importance of policies like paid family and medical leave. And as we noted before, care is a collective act from cradle to grave, and it's also a very intimate and very personal act, whether or not we're parents or caregivers or not. Care and the well-being of all our children requires collective action because all our fates are linked. So Melissa, thanks again for allowing me to go on this deep dive with you.
And Dorian, as always, thanks for being here to deep dive with me. And especially in this moment when it is possible that we are looking at a Supreme Court that will make childbirth a requirement for so many more pregnant people. And it just means we got to look at it. We got to know not the fairy tale. We got to know what it really means. So thanks for helping us to uncover some of that. And as we sign off, we also want to say thank you to all of our guests today. Dr. Joya Criera-Perry, Professor Monica McLemore, Tracy Collins, Lynn Peltrow, Josie Callie Penny, and of course, Heather, my daughter's wonderful surrogate. And before we go, we're going to leave you with a few words from Professor Monica McLemore, because she reminds us we don't have to wait for solutions. Those solutions are already being made right now, today.
We have models around the country where people are getting superior outcomes and superior patient experiences. When I think about the midwifery-led birth centers who aren't just, you know, a place to come have your baby, but it's a family and community wellness center. It is a meeting space. It is a, you know, place to do belly casting and art. It's a place to bring your existing children to learn about childbirth and to be a good family member. It's a place where food and music and, you know, all of the things that we yearn for as humans to feel fully seen, you know, these are spaces that have already been created, that already exist. So yes, I think it's possible. We just have to have the courage and the political will to create those spaces and to make the bold suggestion that everybody deserves all of the structures that are necessary to ensure good health outcomes.
And once again, a reminder that on Friday, the court released its decision to allow a restrictive abortion law out of Texas, which effectively bans most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, to stand. Now, it's only going to be to stand for now. It's kind of a complex decision. And on Monday, we're going to continue to talk about this here on The Takeaway. And I'm sure there'll be much analysis over the course of this weekend. But it's important to acknowledge the court did allow the Texas law to remain in effect for now. It did reject the challenge to the law, which was brought by the federal government. And it has allowed a second challenge, one brought by abortion providers themselves, to proceed. So today, Roe v. Wade remains precedent. Today, people in Texas are unable to access abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. And today, we continue to need to think carefully about the question of childbirth. So we thank you so much for listening and for sticking with us. Be sure to be back to talk with us again on Monday. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.